knights and fair maidens, adventure and romance, triumph and tragedy, chivalry and villainy. These are the Middle Ages, and this is your gateway to the medieval world. I invite you to step back in time and experience All Things Medieval, the podcast dedicated to bringing you knowledge, tales, and insights into the Middle Ages of the past, the present, and of the future. Welcome, lords and ladies, once again to All Things Medieval podcast, the podcast which talks about all things medieval. This is episode number 8 for late September 2008, and I'll be trying to keep this episode down to around about 60 minutes in length. It's springtime in Australia, here in the southern hemisphere, and it's already starting to get bloody well hot. It vexes me muchly, especially so when you folk in the northern hemisphere are no doubt enjoying a wonderfully colourful autumn. Living in subtropical Queensland, I guess we don't get a whole lot of variation in the season. It just sort of gets hot or hot and wet, pretty much. So I must admit I do envy the fact that people in the northern hemisphere, or even in southern parts of Australia, actually have a little bit more variance in the seasons. It just seems to add something to creativity and to your mood and just to, I don't know, just your outlook in general. But enough rambling about that. What have I got to talk about in the introduction this episode? Books I'm reading. Since last time, I haven't really done anything. I haven't even read anything else on the novel Catherine, which I spoke about. I've been reading tiny little bits here and there, but I actually haven't had my head solidly in a book for several weeks now, I think, or at least a few weeks, and that's something I'm looking to rectify. I've been very, very, very busy. Really busy. It's crazy. I've actually had no time to edit a lot of the show notes here, which I'll be reading a lot of as we go along, so I'm probably going to have to skip things here and there, and hopefully it will be cohesive in some way. I've been really busy with my work, setting up my company, Gold Falcon Enterprises Proprietary Limited. It's an amalgamation of many of the things that I do. And at the recommendation of an accountant and financial planner, it's been suggested to me that I go ahead and turn it into a company to basically beat the tax man a little bit. And let's face it, we all want to beat the tax man with sticks mostly, but we want to beat him at his own game as well. So, I mean, that's been keeping me really, really busy. I've actually got a team of about, I think it's 6 people now together, and it's going really well. I've actually been looking forward to copping an injury which renders me useless. Not entirely useless, hopefully temporarily useless, just useless enough that I can just take some time off. That'd be great. I know that sounds a little bit odd, but from time to time in what I do, there is a risk of injury, and a lot of people sort of approach this, especially people who do it as a hobby, approach it as a... I don't want to get hurt kind of thing, but really you're trying to joust each other and knock each other off a horse or chop at each other with swords and axes and things like that, get shot with arrows. So injury is a reality, and where a lot of people are adverse to it, and don't get me wrong, I'm adverse to the pain and the blood and all the rest of it that goes with it. What I'm not adverse to is the doctor saying, now I want you to stay at home and put your feet up and not do anything for several weeks. I really like hearing that. That's great. But as soon as I get some time, I'd like to focus more on the podcast and make it a lot more professional and get some new segments up and running as well. New segments, you say? Yeah, I'd like to do some segments on this day in history, or perhaps this month in history. I'd like to do some segments in regards to combat in the battlefield, the courts, the noble courts, pretty much different things like that, where I can just throw in a little bit of information in between the main segments, just to keep everyone interested. I'd really like this to appeal to a wider range of people, and so I've got to structure it a little bit better. Or keep it a little bit more entertaining and a bit more dynamic, I guess. And I think these new segments would, I think they'd do the trick quite well. As soon as I get some more time, I'm going to do a little bit more work on a novel which I've started to write. Now, I'm not too sure if this novel will ever see print. It is my intention. I hope to have the first draft completed before Christmas. And yes, it's a medieval novel, but it's not a mystery novel, and it's not going to be a novel about... it's going to be a bit different, I think. I don't want to speak too much of it, just in case some sneaky person comes by and pinches my idea. Or, perhaps it's already been done. Who knows? Nothing new under the sun, they say. And we're going to talk about Nothing New Under the Sun a little bit in today's, or this episode's main feature. The main feature is going to be about myths of the Middle Ages. I mean, we talk a lot about myths already, but we're going to absolutely go to war on some of these myths, and we're going to really get down and dirty with them and do them some damage and hopefully send them packing. Do you have a question for me? I haven't had any questions about the Middle Ages for some time. I'd really like some, you know. If you have a question, whether you'd like to hear it answered on the show, or whether you just prefer a private reply for your own curiosity, or perhaps you're studying something, or perhaps you're researching something, let me know, and I'm happy to help out in any way which I am able to is probably a better word just there. I'm thinking of having an art competition. If anyone's seen the logo of the All Things Medieval podcast in the iTunes store, or even on the blog page, it's a fairly ordinary logo which I just smacked together fairly quickly and on a Corel Draw program and just threw it up there because I felt I needed to have something. But if you're rather tricky with an art program, or perhaps the more traditional mediums of art, and you're interested in having a crack at it, I'm thinking of running an art competition and maybe putting up some spiffy prize for the person who submits the winning entry. I'm not too sure, but I'd love to hear if there is any interest. I mean, I have quite a few artist friends who could probably do something like this for me, but I just figure it might be a way to get more listeners interested, or a way rather to reward listeners. I mean, I can get my mates to do some stuff for me any time I like, or any time they have time, I suppose. Shouldn't be so pretentious. But I'd really like to offer something back to listeners who have that sort of talent. Also, if you don't have any talent, I've got some competitions which will be coming up in future podcast episodes. So you don't just have to be talented with art. You just have to be a listener, and I'm going to have some giveaways throughout the episodes. What else do we have? More stuff coming up in the show. We have a fair bit of listener feedback. We have some promos from other podcasts. Now, they've been banking up a little bit, so you're probably going to hear two or three this episode. We'll see how it goes. I'm not too sure if there'll be two or three forevermore, or if there'll just be one or two, or I don't know. We'll just see how we'll play that by ear, see how it goes. But most of these podcasts I've reported on already, but they've been kind enough to send me some promotional stuff, which I'm more than happy to play on the show. Anything to make this old thing look a little bit more flash, a bit more professional than what it really is, suits me fine. And these, as long as it's not too professional, I don't want these promos to outshine me. So if they are too good, ladies and gentlemen who've sent them to me, they'll get canned. No, just joking. I'll play them regardless. We've also got a report on the Cressing Temple event, which is an event in the UK I reported on in the events section last episode. And we have Mr. Paul Etherton over in the UK, who's actually gone along and had a look at said event. And he's done a pretty cool report for us, so I'm going to read that out a little bit later as well. Finally, I've had some email issues again. I'm not too sure what's going on, but emails which I'm sending out are coming back saying they've been refused because they are spam. Now, this has happened on several occasions. So if someone's out there waiting to hear back from me, chances are I may have sent something and it's bounced back. I'm not too sure. In some cases, I get the message, but the message still arrives where it's meant to go. So I'm so confused. I don't get it. It's technology. I'm still a bit of an infant, I guess, in the playground of technology. So if anyone's got any ideas what could be going on there, please do get in touch with me. If you have anything you need to get off your chest with me, get in touch with me here at the All Things Medieval podcast. at podcast@sirjustin.com, or you can head over to the forums at www.sirjustin.com. And while you're there, tell us all what's been happening in your medieval world, and if you've got news you'd like to report on, or different interesting tidbits which you'd like to share, please do. And also, tell me that you like the podcast, or tell me you hate it, tell me how I can make it better, tell me how I can make it worse. Just tell me something. Just get over to the forums and or send me an email and let me know what's going on. Now, also, I'd like to say there's no pressure to get on over to the forums there. I mean, ideally, it'd be something which I'd like to see a bit more busy. I'd like to spend more time on the forums. I'm probably as guilty as anyone else for not being on there posting stuff. But, I mean, how many forums do we all need to be members of? I mean, they're just so hard to keep up with, and there's a wealth of information on them. But you've really got to have the time, don't you? Or the skill to be able to, I guess, multitask and do work or what have you and keep up with the forums at the same time. And quite frankly, I'm not capable of that. And I'm sure many other people are probably in the same boat. So that's about it for the introduction, I think. I'm sure there's stuff that I've missed out on, but hopefully I'll catch up on them a little bit later. Oh, actually, one last thing. I've got an idea for a Viking episode coming up, which got me thinking. There's no good Viking podcasts out there. In actual fact, from when I last checked, there were no Viking podcasts. I'm sure there's some mad Viking enthusiasts out there. By mad, I mean very keen Viking enthusiasts. Why doesn't someone start up a Viking podcast? I think that'd be awesome. I'd listen to that one, and I'm sure many other people would too. I mean, this podcast was started because there was nothing which really suited what I was looking for in a podcast on well, the Middle Ages, I guess. So I had this idea, threw it together, and here we go. We've got something which is halfway decent. I'd like to see someone do that with a Viking episode. Oh, and here we go, I'm starting to remember now. Pod fading. We've all heard about podcasts which start up and then they just fade off and dwindle and die quietly somewhere. I can assure you that if this podcast ever dies, it will die in the noisiest way possible. It's going to go down fighting the whole way. Okay, so there won't be any pod fading. There'll be pod fighting, but no pod fading. It's going to be it's going to be around for a very long time. Something which really disappoints me, and I know it must disappoint other people, is when you find a cool podcast and then all of a sudden it just goes away. You know, and I've seen a few of those. I've found some really cool podcasts in the past, which and found their final episode was episode number 8 or 7 or something like that, and they never continued onward. And it just sort of leaves you hanging. So I won't do that to the listeners. This is something which is going to continue pretty much for as long as I'm living, and as long as I have a voice and fingers to type with and a mind to think with and all those sort of faculties. So as long as I'm intact in that way, you'll always have the All Things Medieval podcast, which is great news to some and possibly a threat to others. But never mind. So that is, I promise now, the end of the introduction, and we'll move straight on to the Herald's Call news.
Bringing you the latest happenings from across the kingdom, here comes the All Things Medieval Herald in the Herald's Call.
Thank you, Herald, for this pile of news which you've dumped upon me this episode. There's stacks here, and as I said, I haven't had time to edit through it, so I'm going to pretty much paraphrase a lot. We'll give it a go. We're on the fly, so let's have a crack at it. The first story is archaeologists in Berlin have uncovered evidence that the German capital is older than previously thought. They found one of the city's oldest graveyards containing 2,300 skeletons. And since March, these archaeologists have been hard at work at Petriplatz Peter's Square, which served in the Middle Ages as a central square of Köln, Berlin's now-vanished sister city. In one corner of the site, octagonal stone steps are the only reminder of St. Peter's Church, which once stood there. It was destroyed and rebuilt 5 times over 700 years and stood as the heart of the settlement until it vanished for good in 1964 in the aftermath and clean-up of World War II. Now, basically, what they've done, they have found this cemetery, and they've turned up foundations of a building. I think it's a school. Yes, a school. They found fountains and a wooden plank, all dated to 1212. Maybe there's some graffiti on it or something like that. I don't know. You know, something that says Fritz was here 1212. They've also found combs, pots, tools, coins, and bottles. And the most spectacular find is in excess of 2,300 skeletons, including a large number of children from the Petrie Church graveyard. They're being documented by age, sex, and probable cause of death before being quietly reburied nearby. And the Rich Hall complicates matters for the plans to redevelop Petroplatz as an inner city square. Now, they're already talking about incorporating museum on the redeveloped site and reintroducing Berliners to their city's origins. So that's pretty exciting stuff. They've basically found a lost city within the city of Berlin. I think that's how it reads. Sounds really, really interesting. It's always fascinating. I mean, we know so little in the world of archaeology. There is so much that is lost to us, and I mean, we just keep turning up things that change our, you know, just change our perspective on history in general. And I think that is very, very exciting. I reckon it's awesome. So the next news story is new research on the sinking of the Tudor ship, the Mary Rose, speculates that the ship may have been lost due to the lack of English language skills by the mostly Spanish crew. The theory might help explain the cryptic shout of George Carew to another English ship that his men were... Let me try that again, shall I? That punctuation has thrown me. The theory might help explain the cryptic shout of George Carew to another English ship that his men were knaves I cannot rule. That was what he shouted. The cryptic shout was not George Carew, but knaves I cannot rule. The theory is based on an examination of the human remains from the ship, which revealed that most of the sailors were foreign. That's very speculative, isn't it? Personally, I prefer a little bit more meat in my theories, I guess. I'm not too sure. You know, that's really odd. I'm going to find out more about that, but the fact that they're saying, you know, I mean, if a ship's sinking, or if, you know, I don't know. If they were foreigners on the ship, I'm sure they must have known how to sail a ship. That just sounds really weird to me. The mind boggles. And so while the mind is boggling, we'll move on to something a little more relaxing. Medieval garden intrigues British archaeologists. The buried remains of a 700-year-old garden at Whittington Castle in Shropshire, England, could substantially change historians' understanding of medieval gardens. The 14th century garden had one of the earliest and largest viewing mounts ever found in England, an unusual layout, and an elaborate ditched water system. Viewing mounts were built to provide elevated views of a castle's garden grounds and surrounding landscape and symbolised the owner's wealth and high status. The Whittington Castle Mount, which is a 16-foot or 5-metre man-made mound, puzzled archaeologists for years. It was originally thought to be part of the castle's defences, or a viewing mount built later in the 16th or 17th century. But the discovery by researcher Peter King of a reference in records dating to 1413 to a garden with a ditch of water around it led archaeologists to conduct a geophysical survey of the area, to which they discovered that their findings suggest the mount and garden were built sometime between 1300 and 1349, which makes it the earliest example to survive in the UK, as well as drastically altering the traditional view that the medieval mounts were very small, low affairs. So yet, something else we have, which has pretty much gone and blown out of the water theories which we've had in place for quite some time. So again, there's that dynamic new research. I guess because we're overcoming a lot of the myths as a whole, researchers are starting to look at things in a different light, I guess, and it's really interesting, you know, the modern technology that we have today and the fact that more and more things, manuscripts, art, are being studied in an accurate way, that we're starting to find out all these stunning new revelations. And like I said, I think that's awesome. The next news item is about medieval global warming. Global warming is currently one of the world's most pressing issues, but the phenomenon of climate change is not specific to our century. And a new book by anthropologist Brian Fagan, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, takes a look at the global effects of climate change that occurred during the medieval warm period and examines how subtle shifts in the environment had far-reaching effects on human existence. The book is called The Great Warming, Climate Change and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's by Bloomsbury Press. And Fagan, a professor emeritus of, I think I've pronounced emeritus correctly, of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara, focuses on the period from the 10th to the 15th centuries when the world experienced a rise in average temperature that changed the climate worldwide. While climate experts tend to focus on melting ice sheets, rising sea levels and extreme weather events such as Hurricane Katrina and the severe flooding it caused, Fagan believes drought is the greater threat. Prolonged dryness was widespread in medieval times and killed enormous numbers of people. Evidence is mounting that drought is the silent and insidious killer associated with global warming. So his book is sounds really interesting, actually. His books on the interaction of climate and human society have established him as a leading authority on the subject, and he's currently the editor of the Oxford Companion to Archaeology and the author of Fish on Friday, Feasting, Fasting, and the Discovery of the New World. He's also the author of The Long Summer and The Little Ice Age, among others. Sounds like a really interesting book. And, yeah, I think for anyone who's interested in global warming and has an interest in the Middle Ages, I think there's a lot to be learned from history, so head out and buy that book and have a look at it. The next news item is, who wants to buy an Irish castle? Over in Ireland, there's a castle for sale. And as soon as the link opens, I'll tell you some more information. But in the meantime, let's talk about... Oh, the Viking Inn in Minnesota. That's a good one. It looks really interesting, you know. It doesn't look 100% historically accurate, but it looks like a whole lot of fun. If you would like some more information about the Viking Inn in Minnesota, head over to www.vikinginn.com. They have a bunch of rooms which are set out in such a way to be pleasing to people who like medieval things. One of the rooms is actually decked out in the paraphernalia and all of the livery and pageantry of the Minnesota Vikings, which I'm guessing is a local sports team. I know there's probably listeners in Minnesota or in the States at the moment who are howling in outrage that I don't know who the Minnesota Vikings are. That's okay. I don't know most Australian sports teams, so... Yeah, sorry guys, but if someone wants to let me know, if someone would like to give me a stern rebuke, please do so over at the forums or at podcast@sirjustin.com. Here we go. So we were talking about buying an Irish castle. Now, in the old days when an Irishman's home was a castle, the drafty structures were built as stalwart defence against marauding bands armed with honed steel and battering rams. And these days, the owners of the country's 1,500 or so castles and medieval tower houses face similarly doughty adversaries in the shape of heritage groups, neighbours with planning objections, and the horrible bank managers. That's a big word I'm not going to try and pronounce. So I'll say horrible bank managers. You do have to be lion-hearted to take one of these on, says Helen Cassidy, a Galway-based auctioneer who specialises in castles. People who buy them tend to have done their homework. As an investment, they are not really a financial one. As these are national monuments, you need good legal expertise to make you aware of anything unapproved that may have been done to them in the past. Because let's face it, these castles, they really didn't know how to build something in the past. No, not like we have today, where, you know, we build our homes and they stand the test of time. These castles, I mean, how old are they? 7,000 years old. Yeah, they're still standing, but hey, you just can't trust that dodgy sort of engineering, can you? So, if you are in the market for a castle, I'd recommend having a look around Ireland. There's a few of them going, apparently, but just be careful. You don't, you know, have a good look, make sure they're structurally sound, make sure there's wheelchair access and stuff like that as well. And yeah, well, say no more. Okay, we have, oh, you guys have got to check this one out. Remember Chris Crocker and his infamous Leave Britney Alone video that he put on YouTube? This time, someone else has done it. I think this may have been Chris Crocker's inspiration. I think he's totally ripped it off. But this one is called Leaveth Anne Boleyn Alone. And it's, check it out on YouTube. It has a distinctly Tudor flair. Yeah, it's pretty funny stuff. So go and have a look at that. I'll put the link in the schnotes, because to read out the URL is just crazy. There's all sorts of MXVs and Ys and boots and something or other. So I'll put that in the show notes. Or you can go to YouTube and type in Leaveth Anne Boleyn Alone and you'll find it. Pretty funny stuff. Okay, what else do we have? Finally, just a quick mention about some of the medieval villages. And by medieval villages, I mean modern medieval villages. There's a couple of them around. Three of them which spring to mind straight off the top of my head is one in the United States. I think it's in the north, or on the Atlantic side of the United States. I'm not too sure. I'm going to have a look at a map. I'm feeling rather daft at the moment. But it is Camlan Medieval Village, and we have another one, which is over in the UK, called Cosmeton. And actually, I've got some news on Cosmeton, which I'll hopefully read up on and report on in the next episode. And this next episode will be coming up shortly. I'm not going to promise that. Okay, so the next episode will be coming, and I'll probably put something about Cozzy, as the locals call it, in that particular episode. And also the Denmark Middle Ages Centre is another village which you guys should check out. I'll put the links to these places in the schnotes, and I might report on them in a little bit more depth and detail next episode. Yeah, I think I could do something like that. But they're basically, they're living history museums, where you can go along and you can see people at work wearing the sort of clothing, doing the sort of chores, living in the sort of, or seemingly living in the sort of environments, structures and buildings which they lived in the Middle Ages. And it's an opportunity for people to step back in time, see what the Middle Ages were really like, and well, you'd be able to see with your own eyes that a lot of the things that the movies portray or that you hear about are simply not true. And they look like a great place where you could just lose yourself in the atmosphere and learn a whole bunch of stuff. So check them out, Camlan, Cosmeton, and the Danish Middle Ages Centre. So have a look, see at those. The Danish Middle Ages Centre, by the way, has some working trebuchets, which from time to time they fire flaming projectiles into the nearby river, and looks very, very stunning. Looks really cool. So yeah, check them out as well. I'll have links to all these items in the notes. So if you want to read up a little bit more on them there, or do some more research on your own, they're a great springboard, I guess, for you to get into it and have a look, see around. So that's all we have for news this episode. If you do have a news story which you'd like me to report on, get in touch with me here at podcast@sirjustin.com, or over at the forums, even just drop us a line and let everyone know what's going on. And now we shall move on to events.
Come hither, lords and ladies, gather round and lend an ear while I tell you about fairs, tournaments and events coming soon to these fair lands.
We have a bunch of events to report on this episode. Always on the lookout for more, time permitting, of course, time permitting in the episode to report upon them. We'll start off with the Abbey Museum of Art and Archaeology. This is the museum which holds the famed Abbey Medieval Festival here in Queensland, in Caboolture, Queensland, which is about 45 minutes from the central business district of Brisbane and heading out towards the Sunshine Coast. You're pretty much halfway to the Sunshine Coast by the time you reach the museum. Now, Their biggest and best event has been and gone for the year and won't be back until next year, but by no means is it their only event. And I'm going to report on a couple of the things which they're hosting for the remainder of the year. Not all of it's medieval, but I will mention a couple of things here and there, such as the collection highlight for the month of September, which, I mean, if you're living overseas or anywhere else for that matter, you've only got about 2 days to get there. Okay, so yeah, that's a little bit late. But you missed out on a special display of Regency and Victorian ladies fans. Very, very interesting stuff. You also missed out on an afternoon tea with Mr. Darcy, which I'm sure would have been a lot of fun. I was away working that day, otherwise I would have liked to have gone and had a look at the, or enjoyed the afternoon tea with Mr. Darcy. But coming up, that was September 2, so you missed out on the quilling workshop. That would have been fantastic, where you get to make your own quill and learn how to do some medieval writing. But rush along for the 1st of October for the gingerbread making workshop. Yes, pretty exciting stuff there. But no, really, they're doing it in conjunction with the Ginger Factory, which is on the Sunshine Coast, and they're actually doing it. It's in a context which is done in the same context, or at least you're learning stuff from the Middle Ages. Am I selling anyone on this? No. Okay, never mind. Well, how about November? Saturday the 8th of November, the museum is hosting, or playing host to, Mr. Nigel Bond of the University of Queensland, who will be doing a talk and discussion or forum on the Canterbury Trails, a change in direction for modern pilgrims. Now, that's a Friends of the Abbey Museum event. Bookings are essential, and it's $35 for the dinner and the talk, or $6 for the talk only, and that's being held at the Abbey Hall. Should be very interesting. In November or month, the collection highlight is Guy Fawkes and the Gunpowder Plot. And yeah, that sounds great. And as always, we have a medieval Christmas, which is the Gregorian chant with a group called Scholar Cantorum from Brisbane, and it's a beautiful little event. It's held in the candlelit Abbey Church with the 11th century. That's the church with the 11th century stained glass, and it's absolutely magical to go along and hear these people sing and chant. In a style which was commonly done, not just during Christmas, but all year round. So that's what's on at the Abbey Museum of Art and Archaeology. I'd head along and check that out if you're in town. Now, what else do we have? From September 2008 to January 2009, the Museum of High Art in Atlanta, Georgia, is playing host to a collection from the Victoria and Albert Museum of medieval and Renaissance treasures. Looks really, really good too. I'd love to get along and check that out, but unfortunately I don't think I'll be able to make it. But if someone over in the area can and does, go and check it out and let us know what it's like. Okay, post some pickies as well. That would be wonderful. I'll put the link to the museum in the notes. What else do we have? We have the medieval towns of, of Monmouthshire. Medieval towns of Monmouthshire conference will take place at the Memorial Hall, Usk, from 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. on Saturday, October 11th, with free coffee, tea and biscuits in the morning. And people will need to make their own arrangements for lunch. But there's lots of excellent venues in Usk, so I am told. Tickets are £7 or £5 for full-time students. I should mention that Monmouthshire is in the United Kingdom, or England specifically. And tickets are £7, £5 for full-time students, and available from Lindwalls in Bridge Street, Usk, or with a self-addressed envelope from Stella Collard, Penwy Wheelod, Lantricent, Ask My... Oh, it's in the schnotes, okay? Check it out in the schnotes. I'll put it in there. They are also available on the door. Brisbane Medieval Fair has been and gone. Haven't heard a whole lot about it, aside from a couple of people whom I'm associated with, who are not a member of the group or not a part of my Gold Falcon Enterprises team, but they are friends and they're trusted companions. They had some concerns about the event and exactly what was happening. I have had a report that the crowd was really poor, and I think it's due to the other dismal events which have been held in the same venue, where the organiser has been a dreadful man to deal with, both from a public viewpoint and from a performer's viewpoint, as mentioned in the last podcast. Won't harp on it too much, but I am disappointed that I do indeed seem to have been correct in my assumption about the event, which, yeah, that's a real bummer. That bums me out. But not to worry, we have another event, which is it's pretty exciting stuff. At least it is if you live in Australia and you're interested in 14th century swordsmanship, specifically the swordsmanship as taught by Fiore, the Italian swordmaster. Now, this is going to upset some of the fans of German medieval swordsmanship. Well, no, probably not, but I'm going to stir the pot anyway and say that it is. And, well, basically, here in Brisbane specifically, we're inundated with the German style of swordsmanship, and it's going to be really refreshing to see some Fiore being taught. And that Fiore is being taught by none other than Bob Charron, who will be coming over from the United States. He's pretty much considered the foremost expert on Fiore, possibly worldwide. I would argue that most people agree that he's the most respected proponent of the martial arts style, and he's going to be over here in Australia, hosted by the Fiore School of Medieval Defence, which is based down in Melbourne, Victoria, in Australia. Now, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Australian enthusiasts of the medieval martial art, the most complete system of martial arts or recorded martial arts in or European martial arts that we have in history. Now, it's going to be held, at this stage it looks like it'll be held in early March. The cost will be $130 to $160 for a weekend seminar with the talented Bob Charron. And looks like it's going to be held in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, of course, and quite possibly on the west coast of Australia in sunny Perth. So it sounds like it's going to be pretty exciting stuff. And tickets will be going on sale in November. I'll hopefully have a little bit more information. I'm sure I could compile it all together if I took the time, but I'll have to do that. I may even post that as a separate blog entry, or check out the forums. I'll put the information on the forums as soon as I compile it all together. If you want to learn more, get in contact with the Fiore School of Medieval Defence, and I will put the contact details in the schnotes. I think that's all we have for events. If you do have an event, get in contact with me, let me know, and I'll be more than happy to plug the event. But before we finish this segment, no, actually I'll put that in the listener feedback. We'll put Mr. Everton's report in the listener feedback section, so do stick around for that. It's and you'll get to hear all about the Cressing Temple event. And so I guess now we shall move on to our very next segment. Tally-ho! And now it's time for the All Things Medieval Podcast main feature. Listen to discourse and interviews where we talk about a featured topic or chat with a special guest. Yes, tally-ho. Not very medieval, but it seemed to fit. So, this episode's feature, we're going to talk about medieval myths. Now, we've touched a lot on medieval myths, and pretty much every episode we find something and we give it a good kick in the pants. And we're starting to, well, hopefully listeners are starting to, if they haven't already, have a good picture of or be able to distinguish between what is true and what is indeed false. What we're going to do with this main feature is we're going to contextualise and rationalise a lot of different medieval myths. Okay, there's a whole bunch of them out there, and it seems that there's never any end to it. So we're going to address a few of the things. Now, we've already spoken about things such as we know the swords weren't terribly heavy, that they were light and well balanced. We also know that the war horses that knights rode were not big, heavy draft breeds, but rather lighter, more agile animals. And most of the myths we do address have some sort of relation to the battlefield, I guess. So we're going to move away from the battlefield in this particular feature, and we're going to look at some of the other more day-to-day kind of things. So remember, it's all about contextualization and rationalization. We've got to remember that sort of formula when we approach myths of the Middle Ages, or not necessarily myths, but anything, any statement you hear or any statement you read or something that you might see on the television, you just have to stop and think. If you stop and think and go, wow, that seems really unlikely that would have happened, chances are it was unlikely, and there's probably more of a rational answer behind it. Now, a lot of these myths, as I have mentioned, come from Victorian era England, pretty much where a lot of it comes from. Now, my good friend Jim Moat from over at History Zine podcast, he's actually given a really good explanation as to why this has come about. I was going to save it for listener feedback, but it might be relevant to the feature, so I might go ahead right now and I'm going to read this out a little bit. Now, this comes from, as I mentioned, comes from Jim Moat, who hosts a wonderful podcast. Actually, I have a promo which I'm going to play a little bit later towards the end of the show. Has a podcast called History Zine Podcast. Now, he writes, I think the rewriting of history you mentioned in the last podcast was largely a result of what we refer to as Whiggish history. At the height of the British Empire in the 19th century, there was a vast outpouring of new history books that were all trying to explain why Britain was so dominant and painting a weird picture of the British race as being somehow superior to everyone else. Whiggish history depends upon an assumption that we are more advanced now, at the time of Jim's writing, than any other time, and so will show a steady progression of events to show how we became so advanced. A fine example of developing your theory first, then bashing all the evidence into shape to support your theory. There were so many of these books, many copying from each other, that a lot of myths and inaccurate history was propagated. We also had a monarchy that had less and less power and was declining in popularity, particularly from the time of the various King Georges, who were, of course, Hanoverian. Queen Victoria managed to reclaim some of the popularity by inventing lots of traditions and customs to portray the majesty and the power of the monarchy. This propaganda campaign worked magnificently, but it does mean that many of the traditions we have now only date back to Victoria, and much of the history has been changed in emphasis and filled with a variety of myths, many of which have been referred to in the All Things Medieval podcast. Thanks very much for that, Jim. That is absolutely bloody awesome, mate. I always wondered, and I actually mentioned in the last podcast, which prompted Jim to send this email, I was actually curious as to why the myths stemmed from this particular period. And that pretty much sums it up beautifully, and it's given me a really good place to sort of delve, or a springboard to delve into it a little bit more and research more on the subject and the topic. So, with that firmly in mind, we shall now have it. Now, I only have a few of them. There's not a whole bunch because I want to keep this this episode hopefully around the 60-minute mark. So we'll fly straight into it. We might talk a little bit about what's a good one to start with. Let's talk about violence and crime. Often we think of the Middle Ages as being rampant with violence. The streets are wild with violence, and there's wars everywhere, and there's all this killing and all this death and murder and just beatings and tortures and all of these sort of things. Okay, so let's look at this in a little bit more detail, shall we? Or rather, let's contextualize it and rationalize it. Okay, violence. For a moment, if you can picture a, let's say a wild tavern brawl. gets out of hand, there may be a stabbing, or maybe there's someone's been beaten to death, there's been a big punch-up, a horrible fray has ensued, and many people have been injured, and maybe one or two have been killed as well. Could we take that just for a moment from the Middle Ages and place that, say, in a nightclub environment of the 21st century? Could we look at any hotel on a seedy hotel or nightclub on a Friday or Saturday night, and could you see a similar thing happening? I think so. In actual fact, I've worked at some nightclubs for many a year, and during the course of working at these nightclubs as a bouncer, I've actually seen two people die in these sort of brawls. Now, these brawls are far more common in certain areas. There's not every establishment has them, of course, but they are far more common than what the average person would expect. I don't see how it could really be that much different in the Middle Ages. Okay, let's look at medieval warfare. What about that? That's horrible. There's people dying in wars, and just, you know, and innocents being killed, and homes being destroyed. And wow, that sounds like a conflict anywhere in the Middle East at the moment. Well, perhaps not anywhere, but you know what I'm saying, really. I mean, violence and warfare has been around since man has ever first walked upon the earth. Hasn't really changed much. To say that it's worse than what it is now, I'd really like a little bit more evidence to go on with that. Really, I really, really would. I mean, you take a look around, turn on the TV, have a look in the newspaper, whatever you like to do, have a look at YouTube. I mean, there's all sorts of horrible things that are happening today. Can we really say that the Middle Ages were much more violent than what we have today, with gang shootings and rapings and theft and things like that? I mean, if anything, because society today is no longer, shall we say, responsible for their own actions, and punishment is more of a luxury than some lifestyles that some of the criminals are leading, can we really say that violence and crime is or was a bigger issue in the Middle Ages? I think that we really need to think about that a little bit more and dispel that myth that it was far worse back then than what it is today. Now, of course, that's subjective, and that's just my own personal opinion. Hopefully it's not looking through rose-coloured spectacles too much, but at least have a think about that. Okay, we'll have a look at health and disease as the next one on my list. Quite often, we're led to believe that medicine in the Middle Ages was crude, and it was horrible. Their sanitary measures were absolutely deplorable. Now, by our modern context, that is actually correct to an extent. But again, we need to contextualise, and then we need to rationalise, okay? We need to look at their levels of technology. A lot of the things that we have today, such as electricity, bleach, I mean, if you want to call that technology, even modern lighting, modern machines, running hot water, a lot of these things were not available in the Middle Ages. Now, the running hot water, there is some debate about that. They believe that there possibly could have been something like that. And even if it wasn't running, they still had access to hot water. Now, more and more, and if anyone's been keeping up to date with the news sections on this particular podcast, more and more research is showing that surgeons in the Middle Ages were capable of quite complex medical procedures. There's been a whole bunch of different things, which is starting to lead us to believe that, well, although by no means was it the standard of our medicine today, it's not quite as crude and ugly as the picture that we quite often paint it to be. In fact, it seems to be quite successful. They actually had medieval painkillers. They had even medieval herbal headache remedies, which really hadn't changed right up until the last century. I remember my dad and my grandfather used to take this powdered form of headache. It was a headache powder. It was kind of like an aspirin, but in powder form. And they'd take this in a little satchel. And it really wasn't all that different to the ingredients that they were using in the Middle Ages for their herbal remedies for headaches and things like that. So, again, not as horrible as we may think it was. Now, the next one, food and manners. That's a good one. You always see the movies. You see people feasting at the table, and they're furiously feeding their face, and they're throwing scraps to the dogs, and you know, and they're swilling ale, and they're spilling stuff, and they're flatulence is rampant, and rampant flatulence at the dinner table. Now we see that quite a lot. In actual fact, that never really happened. In fact, and I think I may have mentioned this on a previous podcast, I'm not too sure, but I have mentioned it many shows that I've done. Our modern way of dining today would be considered crude and rude to medieval standards. Of course, in the levels of aristocracy, it would be even more so, but even the poor old common person, their meals were generally, they'd say grace, they'd wash their hands, they'd clean. There was a certain ritual and social interaction at the dinner table. If you were to sit there and feed your face like an absolute animal, you would probably be beaten for it. Okay, it wasn't something which was commonplace whatsoever, and there were certain rules and etiquettes, some of them very, very complex, and most of them which have gone on to become the rules and etiquette that we have today at our dinner table. Okay, so again, there's another myth which we commonly hear, which is not accurate whatsoever. Okay, now I mentioned you might get a beating for acting like a fool or a pig at the table, which leads into law and punishment. I guess it sort of crosses over into crime as well. Quite often we think of the medieval period as being somewhat, it was either tyrannical or it was anarchy in the Middle Ages. Okay, actually I think Guillaume de Machaut wrote a popular song which was in the medieval top 10 called Anarchy in the Middle Ages. Now we often think that it was very tyrannical, but in actual fact the law system was very fair. The law system that they had set in the Middle Ages was the foundation. Well, actually it all stemmed from classic law in Rome and Greece, but it went on and it developed. It became very complex. It was something which a lot of people say it benefited the rich, and it kept the rich rich and the poor poor. Really, is that any different to how we view our government today? Are we looking at their legal system with our own modern minds when we say those sort of things? I know I used to say things that were very similar to that. I used to have these same sort of thoughts and misconceptions, and they were based purely on what other people told me, or purely upon Monty Python's quest for the Holy Grail, you know, and that kind of bizzo. And it's actually horribly, horribly inaccurate. We have wonderful accounts and details of laws and punishment, and the crimes which lead to the punishment. We have wonderful records of how things were conducted, how they were taken, how they were undertaken in a court of law, and how they were resolved, and then how people went on to be punished. Now, a lot of the time the punishment was very cruel, and we do have to keep in mind that it was more of a pragmatic culture, or a pragmatic part pragmatic part of history, where they thought very practically. And if you have a look at some of the laws that are around today in some of the let's look at the Middle East again, or even in Asia, and even in some parts of Eastern Europe, the punishment that they have for breaking such laws is very, very harsh. Now, does that mean they're barbaric? Does that mean they're not civilized, or does it mean they're not cultured, or does it mean they're not as advanced as Western society? I'm not too sure I'd say that. I certainly would say it's a different culture. They have a different context, and you can't really sit back and judge why they're doing it that way. You need to study more of the culture. You need to immerse yourself more in it, and once you can do that, you can get an understanding of why they're doing the things that they do, such as stonings an honor killing thing, different things like that. Now, I don't condone those things, and myself, being brought up where I've been brought up and how I've been brought up, I don't understand why they continue to do that to this day. But certainly the people who live in that culture, they don't think it's anything out of the ordinary. Now, it doesn't mean it's right or wrong, just means it's different. So we need to look at law and punishment in the Middle Ages with that concept firmly in mind, or with that context and that rationalisation. So again, I've lost my point a little bit on this one. I was going to mention purely tyrannical actually never really happened. From time to time it may have, but no more than perhaps we may see tyranny in Western culture today. And punishment, as I mentioned, was severe, but it was always fitting to the crime, and it was a different sort of, it was a different culture, different mindset. Okay, we'll move on to travel before I mess that last one up too much more. Travel. We often think that people in the Middle Ages didn't really travel very much. They just lived in their village, and many of them didn't even really see, you know, the town over the next hill. That's possibly quite true, but they did actually travel a lot more than we're led to believe. If you imagine we have cars, planes, and trains today, back then they had ships, horses, and feet, and they actually did do quite a lot of walking, a lot of pilgrimages. A lot of people were involved in trade as well, to where the ships would come into play, and also there were a lot of horses in the area, or horses, I should say. That was a really funny sounding statement. I should rather say that horses were a common mode of transport. Now, a lot of people couldn't afford a horse, but many people could on the same token. And so travel wasn't as limited as we might think it is today. Now, let's put something into a modern context, and we'll try and rationalise it in this way as well. I know a gentleman who lives in the same area that I live in. He has never left the area. I mean, it's a suburb of Brisbane. The furthest south he's ever travelled is probably about 45 minutes south of Brisbane. He's never travelled any further north than about an hour north of the city, and he's never travelled west. He has spent his whole life, now he's coming on 40 years old, and he's spent his whole life pretty much in Brisbane, and hasn't even seen, I would say, probably hasn't even seen an eighth of the suburbs of what is in Brisbane. Now, I have spoken to many, many other people who have had very similar experiences. Because I've travelled a lot, when I get talking to people, it becomes a somewhat of a topic where people will relate their own travel stories in that that they've had hardly any. Now, we can imagine that kind of thing would have happened in the Middle Ages as well. You would have had a lot of people that had done some travel, perhaps moved from shire to shire, depending, especially during the time of the plague, when they were fleeing the plague or looking for work, things like that. But certainly they weren't as secluded as we often paint them to be. Okay, we might talk about... what have we got now? We might talk about intelligence. Yes, that's pretty much the last one I have on the list. We often think that our medieval forebears were dummies. We think that they weren't terribly bright. They weren't very clever. Okay, now we might... We'll take the example, we'll look at a clock. Okay, I'm looking at a clock right about now. Now, I might pause to wonder how many listeners know how to construct a clock. Now, I don't mean just buying a clock face and sticking a battery in it and then building a frame around it and what have you. I'm talking about how many people know how to put the cogs together and all of these things, you know, and slot them together and do this particular complex job. It may say it takes a person of great intelligence. Rather, I would argue it takes a person who has a certain level of skill to be able to do that. But let's go back to the early 14th century, perhaps the late 13th century, when the clock was first invented. Was that guy really a dummy? I mean, if so many of us don't know how to construct a clock in our day and age, can we really say that back then people were absolutely stupid? It really only takes one person to come up with a great idea and point people in a certain way, a certain direction, and people will follow and advance on that. We've been lucky enough that we've been born into an age where the human culture has advanced incredibly. The technology that we have today is by no means a testament to our our intelligence as a race in this particular time period. Okay, it's been built upon foundations upon foundations upon foundations, and there's still many things that we actually don't know how were done in the Middle Ages with their crude or rudimentary tools. Without our modern things, I mean to say, we don't know how they would have accomplished such things. The pyramids are one of a great example. I know that's later than the medieval period, but it just goes to show that it's not so much a question of intelligence, but a question of technology, really. Admittedly, if you look back into the past, there are certain periods of history where there seems to be leaps and bounds of advancement in certain things, such as medicine, the arts, technology, things like that. But by no means should we think that people in the Middle Ages were absolute dummies. Let's take, for example, if we go out and buy ourselves an axe from the hardware store today, there's a safety sticker on that axe saying, you know, caution, you know, axe is sharp. Gee, you would think after a couple of thousand years of axes, we would have worked that out. Did they have safety stickers in the Middle Ages for their axes or for any other tool for that matter? I think not. I mean, let's have a look at the blow dryer. On the blow dryer, generally when you get it out of the box, there's a little safety slip that says, do not use while in the bath or in the shower. Really? Lucky we're so intelligent that, you know, we've thought of putting these labels on these things so people don't make these sort of mistakes. I think I've driven my point home there in a roundabout kind of way. Okay, now the final myth that I'd like to address, and I'd like to be very serious about this one, is Conan the Barbarian. Now, a lot of people believe that Conan the Barbarian was a mythical figure. We all know that, in fact, he was a true-to-life historical person. And we actually have evidence of that because of the man who chronicled his stories, Robert E. Howard. He actually witnessed Conan the Barbarian come to him through some sort of time-shifting thing. He's come to him and with an axe, a bloodied axe in hand, more or less threatened him and said, you write my chronicles and I'm going to give you the chop. So we actually have evidence that Conan the Barbarian was real. Now, a lot of people have tried to tell me that he's mythical, that he's a fictional character, that he never really existed, and that gets me really upset. So I just thought I'd debunk that myth as well. Conan is real, he's a real person, and you know, well, I've just told the story, I don't need to elaborate that any further. I actually got into an argument with a professor at the museum that I do a bit of work at in regards to this, and he actually, after I presented my case, he actually conceded. He said, yes, that is absolutely true. Now, will you please stop choking me? Let me loose from the headlock. Now, admittedly, I force my argument fairly passionately, but all I mean to say is if a professor's come round and has admitted that Conan the Barbarian is a real-life historical figure, I really think it's time for the community at large to start to accept this, or at least approach it with an open mind. Okay, I'm sick of getting into fist fights about this kind of thing. So we'll establish that Conan the Barbarian, as chronicled, not written, as chronicled by Robert E. Howard, was a true historical figure. Okay, and that just about does it for the main feature, I think. We'll move on. Now, we're rapidly approaching. We've already reached the 60-minute mark, so yes, there's something else which I've just sort of let slide, and we'll move on to rapidly onto the marketplace.
Let us venture forth, lords and ladies, into the busy marketplace. Wares of all kinds you will find here. Stick close, and I'll keep the cut purses and charlatans off your backs. I know of a merchant house just over here where we can relax and take our time considering today's goods and services. Ah, here we are now. Let's go inside and lose this crowd, shall we?
Free stuff is going to be the theme of this episode's marketplace, and nothing is more free than podcasts. Yes, they don't cost you anything, and there are many, many very cool podcasts to check out. Now, this is this sounds like a bit of a cop out, sounds a bit cheap, but I'm going to put the promos of the podcasts which I was speaking of earlier in the show in this little segment right here. I would like to mention one thing, actually, is a book about Templars, Templar sites and life in the Middle Ages and more. Trish Colton from Dayton co-wrote The Knights Templar in Yorkshire with her sister, Diane Holloway. And this new book explores what medieval life was like during the Templars' stay in the country of England. In the county of Yorkshire. The Templars owned more land, property and people in Yorkshire than in any other county in England. Is that people? They own people in Yorkshire? Wow, that sounds interesting. And this book, this particular book, it's only just come out, and it's £12.99 with a discount of 20% if you order it online. Check out www.yorkshiretemplars.co.uk for more information, and I shall put that in the show notes. I shall also put links to these following podcasts in the show notes. Now, one that I've mentioned already is Mr. Mowat's podcast, which is historyzine.com. Now, I'd check that one out. That's really cool. Now, the last few episodes he's been doing have been talking about the 18th century. Now, the 18th century, now, for people who know me are quite aware of this, but for the listeners who don't know me as well, I'm a big fan of the 18th century. In fact, if I wasn't doing 14th century professional reenactment, I would likely be doing 18th century professional reenactment. I love the 18th century. It is it's just a wonderful, wonderful part of history, and they're just, yeah, their culture and their history, and it fascinates me muchly. The other culture I really like is, of course, Viking. So if I had to choose something other than 14th century, it would be a toss-up between doing something with Vikings, probably around the 9th or 10th century, or something in the 18th century. But I digress. I was talking about Jim's podcast, History Zine. Very informative, very entertaining. And I mentioned the website address. I'll put it in the show notes. And right about now, I shall play a promo for his podcast.
Greetings, Sir Justin, and to all the people out there listening to All Things Medieval. I bring you news of History Zine, a history magazine in audio form. Our regular features include history podcast reviews, a section I've rather pithily entitled My Linguistic History Trivia Bit. Okay, it's not that pithy. Well, in the past we've learned to gird our loins, sleep tight, and examine the origin of the word cabal. The main meat of the podcast is our special feature. In each episode, we unfold the progress of the War of the Spanish Succession. This war in 1701 to 1714 completely changed the face of Europe, and possibly sowed the seeds for many of the later developments, such as the British Empire, such as the French Revolution, and the vast reduction of the power of Spain. I'm having great fun recording it. I hope you'll come along to listen. It's historyzine.com. Or search for History Zine on iTunes. Hope to see you there. Thanks for listening. And thanks to you, Sir Justin, for inviting me on the show. Bye for now.
Oh, bugger, Jim. That was bloody awesome, mate. If I had have listened to that before actually recording the show, I probably wouldn't have put it on. Or at least I would have tried to do something to make my show live up to the standard of your promo. Thanks a lot, mate. But in all seriousness, it's a great show. I've been listening to it for a little while, and I'd recommend for anyone that actually likes this show to head on over and have a listen to Jim's show at historyzine.com. It really is a fantastic show. And Jim is one of those lucky buggers who's living in the Northern Hemisphere, so he gets to see the full colour range of the seasons, as well as get to see all these wonderful historic sites, which, that's two things. Well, three if you include your promo. Three things now that I'm envious of. So I'll be spending a little bit of time in the chapel after this show, I believe, begging forgiveness for that particular sin. So what else do we have? We have another promo from Celtic Myth podcast. I've mentioned this one before. This one's a lot of fun too. It's very entertaining, and as the title suggests, is all about Celtic myth. So let's have a listen to their promo as well.
Do you have Celtic roots? Are your ancestors from Ireland or Scotland or Wales? From Cornwall, Brittany, the Isle of Man or Gaul? Do you love stories and tales? Ancient myths, legends and folklore of the Celtic peoples? Do you want to hear more about King Arthur, Gwydion, Taliesin, Cuchulain, wild magic and the realms of the Otherworld? Do you want to hear about the old gods, druids and fairies in a way that they're not just dusty, dry words on a page? Then you need the Celtic Myth Pod Show, available from CelticMythPodShow.com. In the days when the world was young, the days when the air was clean and the dew was fresh upon the grass.
Listen well, for I have tidings for you. Warriors are coming from across the sea.
Tring, take this message back with you. Tell the Firbolg they must give my people either battle or live in peace in half of Erin.
On my word, I should prefer to give you half of Erin than to face your weapons.
The Celtic Myth Pod Show will bring you the bravery of heroes and heroines, the magnificent pantheon of gods and goddesses, and the magic and wonder of druids, fairies, and folklore. Our ancestors would listen to these stories as told to them by their bards. They wouldn't read them in books. This podcast brings the magic of sound back into our legends. A new episode comes out twice a month and builds into a complete collection of tales from Celtic mythology. So just sit down, get comfortable, and join us every other week. Listen to news, chat, and a story from Celtic mythology with the Celtic Myth Pod Show from CelticMythPodShow.com. That's CelticMythPodShow.com.
Oh, excuse me for a moment.
Bugger!
That's another great promo there from another great podcast. Yes, it does make me kind of regret the neglect which I've left the All Things Medieval podcast in. But yes, well, I see that the standards have been set very highly indeed. And gentlemen, I shall accept that challenge and I shall rise to it eventually. Just give me a week or two. If you can just wait for me to take that stunning fall from the horse with half a lance protruding from my face, neck or body, then I'm sure that I can rival what you're doing without a problem. Well, no, I can't really back that up either. But nevertheless, a couple of really good podcasts. I would urge you to check them out. I'm going to play the promos on the next episode as well, but I'm going to I'll drop them in. I've got another different one from Jim, so I'll place that in somewhere else, and yeah, we'll mix them up a little bit, and we'll advertise these great podcasts a little bit more. Thanks, guys, for sending those in, and thank you for your continued feedback and input for the show. I value it muchly, and I'm honoured to be in such company as esteemed gentlemen as yourselves. Thanks very much. So that is the end of the marketplace. Like I said, it's a bit of a cop out. I could have really put those into the news section or somewhere else, really. But nevertheless, that's the marketplace for this episode. Next episode, as long as I remember, and I've got notes, so I should be able to remember, I'm going to focus a little bit on purchasing armor, the do's and the don'ts, and what to watch out for, and some recommended suppliers and some not so recommended suppliers, or rather some, well, I guess be aware of what you're buying suppliers. Okay, so we'll talk about that in the next episode. Hope to see you along for the marketplace. And now we shall move on to some listener feedback.
Sile Filomena pro tempore, Sige Cantilena de Pectore, oh, oh, Totas Florio, Iam amore virginales Totas Dario, Norvos, Norvos amos, Caperio, Norvos, Norvos amos.
Did that make you jump out of your seat a little? Possibly did. I wanted to include that. That was actually a group which I forgot to mention in last week's Medieval Marketplace called In Extremo, a German group who, as you can tell, have some strong medieval influences mixed with some modern rock, I guess, or modern metal music. It's really entertaining stuff, and if you like either genre, probably if you like the rock or heavy metal genre, you'll probably appreciate it far more. But really interesting and eclectic mix of music. It's wonderful. And there's a couple of other bands which fit along those veins. Subway to Sally is one of the better known ones, and Corvus Corax as well. So check them out if you get the opportunity. And they're pretty cool. So that's all I need to say about that, I think. And we'll move on to listener feedback and our final sort of closing out notes, I guess. What have we got here? I received an email from Canada from a lady by the name of Rebecca, and she just wanted to write in to say that she's enjoying the podcast, and she's... I'll read a little bit of her email. I won't read the whole thing, but it says that I grew up on a diet of Arthurian legends and other historical lore and fantasy, and this period in history, among others, has always been a passion of mine. Your podcast is really interesting and informative. I especially like the episode about swords and sword fighting, which may come in quite useful for me as I write or attempt to write a lot of historical fantasy work in my spare time, and the episode about women in the Middle Ages. Keep up the good work. I'd let you know about the only medieval fest that we seem to have here in Montreal, the Salon Medieval, but unfortunately that took place in April, so that information is terribly out of date. But that's okay, Rebecca. Thanks very much for your email, and we'll mention the Montreal Salon Medieval, and I'll do a little bit more research. I meant to actually do that before the show, but something else I've neglected. But that's really good, to really handy to know. And best of luck to Rebecca on your writing. I really hope to read something of yours sometime in the future, and wish you the best of luck with it. Okay, what else do we have? We have some more feedback from that's right, our friend Paul. Paul Etherton from the UK. He offered to go. Well, he was going along to the Cressing Temple event, since it's not far from his abode, and he thought he'd go along and have a look, and if we were interested, do a bit of a report. To which I replied that yes, very interested. Thanks very much, Paul. So Paul has been kind enough to send along the following review on the event. Now, where are we? We'll start. He only got down there on the Saturday because he was pretty busy. I can relate to that. And the events that were happening were more or less the same on both days, he writes. So, he also says he's not much of a journalist, so apologies if I start babbling a bit. I'm sure, Paul, if people are listening to this podcast and if they've listened to more than one episode, they're more than used to babbling, mate, and you can't be any worse than me. So here we go. Paul writes, I got there on Saturday just in time to see the arming of the knight, which was pretty much what it sounds like, but the commentator explained what each item was and what its purpose would have been. This was then followed by a sword tourney with some Mickey taking from both sides, which was really good to watch. Mickey taking, for anyone who doesn't understand that colloquialism, is it's like, well, I guess it's a term which means they were trash talking each other, pretty much. So he says it was really good to watch, and it was one of the guy's first fights, and he was really going for it. So full marks to him. If you remember his heraldry, Paul, if you could describe his heraldry to us, perhaps we could give him a bit of a plug, and we can, you know, rev him up a little bit, put a bit of pressure on him for the next one. So he writes, Paul continues, they finished up with some melee, which went down well with the crowd, as everyone loves to see people knocking seven bells out of each other. Oh, do they what, sir, do they what? Don't mind having seven bells knocked out of me either, I might add. He continues, I then had a look around the barns and the trade stalls, so unfortunately missed Devil Stick Pete juggling. That sounds really, really interesting. Paul does say that he's heard that Devil Stick Pete juggling is meant to be really good. There were quite a few traders there selling items for the public and the reenactor alike, and I especially liked the stall with the different types of olives they were spot on. He had a look around the barns and writes they have trade stands in some of them, and one of them has a sort of museum in it which tells you about the Templars and what the barns would have been used for. There's a nice walled garden there, but I didn't manage to get a chance to have a look around since it's literally only just down the road. He'll have a look later on. So that sounds really cool. Sounds like a lot of fun. Okay, he continues a little bit more. Oh, I've really got to do my homework on this so I don't muck these up so much. But he writes there was quite a bit of living history going on with a tent spread out over the whole site with people cooking and lots of people mucking about with armour and kit, etc. So there was plenty of stuff for the punters to walk around and look at. He had a good chat with one of the guys from the Knights of Honour, who seemed like a really cool bunch of guys. He was demonstrating medieval weapons and armour to people, and showed him the ways of holding and using the different weapons. After that, Paul went to watch the falconry display, which was really good. I think the guy must be based on the premises, as he was also at the Viking festival I watched a few months ago. I think that's festival, or it could be the Viking bird display. After that, there was another tournée, this time with the same guys as before and the Knights of Honour, so there were quite a few of them fighting, and the melee combat at the end was very fun to watch. He did have to go after that, so he missed out on the archery display and the cavalry display, but Paul has been convinced that he wants to do some medieval reenactment as well as the Civil War stuff, and he got some really good advice from the guys at the Knights of Honour, and would like to say thank you very much to them. So he also apologises if he's rambled on a bit too much. That's okay, mate. I've rambled on plenty, so your report looks absolutely stunning, my friend. That's really cool. Thank you very much, Paul, for taking the time and the effort to send that in. And I would encourage any other listeners, if you've got any reviews on goods, on movies, on games, on books, on events, anything whatsoever, send them in to us. We'd love to hear, and I'll have all sorts of fun making all sorts of mistakes reading it out for the world to hear. So that's all we have for feedback. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for taking the time and effort to send that in and being a part of the show. I appreciate it very, very muchly. And that is about it for episode 8 of the All Things Medieval podcast, and hopefully I shall see you again soon. Now, I know I said that at the end of the last episode, but this time, maybe, possibly, it could happen. Now, I don't know for certain. Don't hold me to it, okay? But I'm going to try my darndest. In actual fact, now that the company's very close to running by itself, where I can sort of take a little bit of time off, one of the first things I'll be doing is doing some more podcasts, because I really enjoy doing it. I enjoy the interaction with the listeners, and I enjoy the feedback, and it's just a whole lot of fun. Where else can I get to crap on without interruption and ramble about all this medieval stuff, which normally people are tapping their watch going, "We've got to go now, Sir Justin, you've got to finish it. The kids have got to get on the bus," you know, so, or the old people are falling asleep. So it's really good. I love this format. It's a whole lot of fun, and hope to see you all, and all of your friends as well. Don't forget to tell your friends. Hopefully speak to you all in episode 9 coming out next month at a computer near you. And this is the part where if this podcast was a little more professional, I would explain to you all the legalities and the Creative Commons thingies and all that bizzo. But we might just go medieval and say, "Don't pinch it or I'll chop your head off." Okay, at least just ask permission if you want to use something from it. Other than that, I think it's all like Creative Commons bizzo, except of course for the music by In Extremo, and that's about it. Yeah, I don't think they'll chop your head off. I think they'll just sue you. So yeah, so okay, and that's the end. And now we shall we'll leave you with the final credits. I mean final credits. No. Closing credits, which will start soon-ish. You can contact All Things Medieval Podcast with your praise, criticisms, suggestions, questions and other feedback at podcast@sirjustin.com. Join in the forums over at sirjustin.com by clicking on the forums tab in the menu. Check out the goods for sale at www.themedievalemporium.com. Music is by Kevin MacLeod, used with permission at www.incompetech.com.